Hi, guys.
Hi.
Welcome. Third episode.
Hey.
Hi, Rick.
Greetings, Earthlings.
And who are you, fine sir?
Oh, I'm Jim Shears in Madison.
Thanks for joining us, Jim.
Oh, my pleasure.
And you, what do you know about? What you know about ancient America, or what do you know?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Well, years ago, I got started with Isaac and Joe Mann and those people. At that time, it was forbidden to have meetings like this, anything about Columbus, before Columbus, and Joe Mann had set them up outside of the universities. And he was pulling in people from Pakistan, hundreds of people. And of course, he went and died. And my input was the surveying of Indian mounds up here and the obvious input geometry from Europe. And I continued doing it. And so I can add my perspective of what 30 years of research on geometry has to show, and that's not easily faked. People don't move Indian mounds or build Indian mounds these days to encode their ancient knowledge.
And okay. Rick, this is your show. I apologize.
No, it's our show. But you had a question. Go ahead and do it.
Well, Jim, it's more of a statement. I mean, Jim, I've heard from a lot of people that you're basically the most experienced and best Indian mound surveyor in the United States. Is that possible?
Well, I've surveyed more probably than anyone else, and we've surveyed with high precision. Don't use magnetic compass. But people don't like what we're finding. And so depending on who you talk to, our surveys are unreliable because we don't correct for magnetic declination and that stuff. We don't use magnetics, we use the sun. So to answer your question, we have surveyed, my colleagues and I, for 40 years, Indian mounds in Wisconsin and elsewhere, and the geometry tells its story. And you've got to first have the courage to look at the geometry, and that doesn't mean everybody does. So we've got lots to say, but we're in an area where a lot of people simply don't want to hear what's there. I had a threatened lawsuit if I didn't remove golden ratio geometry from the layout of some mounds in Wisconsin years ago, and I don't think that's changed much. The people who objected probably still stick to their guns of belief the way before Columbus.
So basically, it's not necessarily because of the European influxes, as I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it is because the people who lived here, whoever they were, couldn't possibly have been smart enough to understand mathematics.
Exactly. The mathematics are more complex than we teach in our schools, mainly because during, I don't like to say this, but when the Christians came to power, 500 AD, they burned the libraries of Alexandria, say it was only done by pagans under the influence of the devil. And so we lost all that geometry. Here it wasn't lost, and it shows us a good insight what was going on in Europe. And of course, people don't like that either, that the Indians know more than Europeans.
Well, they had larger cities at the time too, but that's a whole different story.
I beg pardon?
I said they had larger cities at the time here than they had in Europe, and that's a whole different story.
Oh, sure.
So, but it brings up another question I had. And in your view, is the same science and same mathematics that goes into creating such good, well-executed geometric figures adequate to navigate the seas?
Absolutely. What I see is encoded in these effigy mounds are not anything that they need to lay out burial sites. It's encoding their high geometry. just like the Pyramid of Egypt, the Great Pyramid of Egypt, encodes the golden ratio. There was a reason for it. And yes, if you understand how the geometry in the mounds, why they're there and so forth, you got everything you need to navigate the earth without spherical trig, which we say we have to get from Alberini, who invented geodesy 1000 AD after visiting India.
Well, yeah, but we also, just recently, someone decoded a new Sumerian tablet in cuneiform that showed how they did geometry and other mathematical functions. And they did it with a series of ratios instead of how we do it, but with the same level of accuracy as we do it, just simpler to use.
Sure. Our trig is nothing more than ratios on a right triangle.
Right.
In the same basic language, much more basic than we teach. It's common in Europe and here, and it goes, must go back thousands of years, many thousands of years before the pyramid, kept probably in secret lodges and meetings where they didn't write it down. They passed it on verbally.
Well, it also brings up another, a segue, if I may, where when Archimedes was killed by the Romans, at the moment he was killed, he was working on something that sounds like the Sumerian form of these mathematics. He said, "Don't disturb my circles." And that is basically the same central theme of how the Sumerians solved all this.
Yeah, agreed.
So maybe he had rediscovered it right at the moment of his death.
Well, I think it was the ancient knowledge, and he was working on a particular problem, but it was all ratios. They didn't have trig in those days, trig tables.
Agreed. But the idea of it working here, I've seen in a number of examples, particularly in Kansas and Eastern Colorado, where they laid out perfect right triangles that covered miles. And you've surveyed some like that.
Well, yeah. My education into this, I came in as a surveyor, engineer, to the Indian mounds. And I was met by a guy who was a keeper of the site, he said, at Lizard Mound Park. He was a Native American, and he took the effort to meet us, and making sure that we didn't have any shovels, and he started educating us. He said, we were part of a world community, and we knew it, and that the teachers in our lodges, a big college, he said, was at Newark, Ohio, which he called the Great Powwow Grounds and we call Newark Mounds, is a college, he said. And they had people there from around the world, just like we had visiting students teaching in our classes at that time. And to augment that, the Newark Holy Stones were found by a surveyor in the 1800s at Newark. And they still exist at Coshocton, although the authorities so ridiculed the guy who found it that he committed suicide. But that is clearly something written in old square Hebrew of the Ten Commandments. And that's at Newark, Ohio, where he said they had a college. And he said they also had surveyed the entire country, entire continent. He called them the Thunderbird lines. And these went across the land just like our trigonometric lines, triangulation networks that we set up in the 1800s to be control for our USGS topo maps. Well, they evidently had the same thing, used the same techniques. And various tribes have said that, visiting, going back with the trade ships for a year to visit in the homelands, teach in other countries. So it was part of a world community, and the geometry we find in very small scale in the mounds or all across the country, and surveying for a Cheyenne medicine man, or he's dead now. He was one of the last keepers of the Sky Knowledge, the Cheyenne. He wanted us to survey the Bighorn Wheel so we could find a site up in the UP, 900 miles away. And we surveyed it. He found the site. And we didn't use spherical trig. It's all basic, what you can do with a plane trig if you can see what's going on.
Yep. I mean,
which is that he was using rump lines, lines that sailors follow. And we use great circle lines and spherical trig, and then we have to convert to rump lines. There's a simple way of doing it. And yeah, the geometry goes all the way across the country between high sites. And there's no reason it can't go across the ocean as well, as you understand.
Right. Yeah. And that kind of relates back to the research I've done with the line of sight communications thing.
Exactly. It's,
and geometry works the same way for that.
Sure. And if you're signaling for surveying, there's no reason if you know Ogham that you can't signal with a mirror and communicate essentially the same as
right. Most. Yeah, what I've discovered is that Ogham was the more old world method. In the new world, they used a syllabic style alphabet. They used a syllabary instead of an alphabet. And a certain set of characters could mean an entire syllable instead of just one letter. So communication went faster for them than it did for the old world version. But the techniques, the technology was the same.
Well, keep in mind too that they say that Ogham was used by the Romans as a military secret.
Yep.
And so we get into military secrets, and even though the need for the secrecy is over, it's still a secret and held kept secret by other people.
And one of the reasons it became known as a magic language.
Magic language, because most people can understand it. And that's one of the things, 40 years of experience probing these mounds and their geometry have shown too, that secrecy is of the greatest importance. Your important stuff is always encoded. And once you understand that and can go through the encoding, then it becomes clear. But secrecy, just like Plato talking about the golden ratio, he did it in a manner that nobody could understand him unless they knew what he was talking about.
Had an insight to begin with, yeah.
And so, Jim, I just learned this from, is it Don McMahon, his work, never heard this before, that the mounds up in the UP and stuff have more of like a 45 degree latitude to the mounds, but the ones down in the south have more of like a 20 degree latitude, almost like saying where they came from across the sea. Is that possible or?
Yes. Latitude is encoded one way or the other in many of our sites. And down at Teotihuacan in Mexico, you've got the main avenue, which had to be a purpose, had to do with north, south at all. When chased up, it comes to the copper country up here, as do most of our long alignments, because it was evidently key in the summertime for a lot of people. And the sides of those temples along the avenue have certain angles, about four different angles, and they correspond to latitudes as you go north. The latitude from north is encoded in many of our mountain groups. And that was the first thing they obviously did. They set up where they're going to lay out a site, a way of observing the rotation of a star around the central north pole to get true north. And they could do it to within a tenth of a degree, it looks like from our data. We tested it to 0.2 and degrees, just on one or two tests, get a lot better than that. And then latitude is a byproduct of the same thing. And that's what they do, establishing true north and the cardinal directions. Then you can lay out all kinds of things, latitudes, long range alignments, calendars function of some kind is almost in every group.
Well, it's integral to the entire process. Jim, have you spent any time examining the Dresden Codex from the Yucatan?
I have years ago. It is, of course, a ephemeris of Venus, and that's one of the main things we find up here in this country. The sun has its calendar, 365 days and a quarter. The moon, its own calendar. Venus, 8 years, and it's incorporated into the Mayan calendar. And Mercury at 13 years, but repeating the same day in 52 years. So we got 52 years, 8 years. Symbolism, the sun, the moon, and two planets. And we have sun, moon, and Venus up here, all part of the, I should say, the calendar of North America, because it isn't just the Mayans. Cherokees have reported the same kind of calendar.
Right. Now, yes, and I was going to segue into another site that may incorporate all those things, and that is American Stonehenge in New Hampshire, Salem, New Hampshire. Would you agree that it has at least the possibility to incorporate all those things into its calendrical observations?
I visited, it's one of the first sites I visited, and I changed my research from satellite studies to this because I knew there were more unanswered questions right on Earth than we can get from space. My perception that this is old world, I saw the same stuff when I was in Germany in the army. The influence and the presence of Mercury, though, seems to be more recent in our work up in Beaver Island. The sun, the moon, cross-quarter days of the sun, all that's there. But only at one site, which is at a lower level, which meant that it would have been later in time, has Mercury and Venus incorporated. And so it developed, of course, as all astronomy does with time. And my perception is that perhaps these came later, although Mercury was a symbol, still a symbol of high knowledge to the doctors from the European secret lodges. I haven't seen Venus and Mercury at America Stonehenge. I hadn't really surveyed it. I've looked at other people. But certainly sun and the moon, same there as in Stonehenge in Europe and the Canadian Stonehenge. But the point is that the big mystery of how the American astronomers correlated the cycles of Mercury and Venus to that of the sun is a mystery. It's all clear up here. Northernmost set of all of them.
How about that? Yeah, the at American Stonehenge, I noticed on the east facing line of stones, there were 8 different stones. And I figured, good possibility they would match up with Venus, but
it could well be. They would have known that very, very early. the the Venus calendar, of course, was used to set the Olympic Games of the Romans. Yep. It's still in the sky, although its name at the time of Jesus was Lucifer.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people believe Lucifer fell from heaven, is now in hell because of a dream by John the Divine. But it's still in the sky if you look. And our
yes.
presidential elections are still held, according to them. But we don't tell people that.
Yeah, yeah. But you mentioned the Olympic Games. It brings up another kind of related thing, and that is the Antikythera device.
Mm-hmm.
A highly, carefully, skillfully engineered and manufactured, I would have to call it navigation aid.
Navigation astronomy, yep.
Yeah, and it was, 100 BC, I believe it was dated at?
Yeah. They had their tools, and there's... I'll get my version of their tools that they use for this. The name, basic name, is Torquatum. The Chinese were using that when they were guiding their fleets of discovery. It was used and displayed in parks in India and China, and we still use it.
Yeah.
We're using in the Second World War.
Yep.
And from it
comes, now we have an electronic version instead of all mechanical, but.
But they were using mechanical versions in the Second World War to guide the fleets. And again, we get, that's probably secret at that time. And so we don't talk about it much, but it's very simple. And the basic geometry is also of use for longitude.
Yes.
You don't need it for latitude, but for longitude, it's very handy.
It initially, when people were investigating the possibility of it being used for, I'm saying recent non-military, basically archaeologists instead of engineers, they said, It seems like it's a bunch of junk that could possibly tell us when the Olympic Games are going to be held. It's like, well, that is part of it, but it can also predict the eclipses of the moon and the sun with extreme accuracy. And in order to do that, they had to build an ellipse into some of the gears. This is not something that you did in a workshop in your basement. Not usually. The engineers who studied it said, this is not just a one of a kind. These things were manufactured. And I agree. So anyway, the devices and the uses of such devices and the principles behind them go back literally thousands of years, possibly much longer. The principles could be used with other tools with lower accuracy.
Yeah. I wish I had brought in the Torquatum. It's in the other room. It's what they use in the Second World War. It's just a Torquatum, mainly for guiding bombers at night and in the daytime by using the sun and a star or star for defining true north. But if we want to understand what's been lost in our history that the Chinese once understood, this has use for their method of finding longitude. The way I understand it, that when the fleet left Nanjing, China, they determined what star was directly overhead at midnight in Nanjing. and defined all the other ports that they visited as at what star or what port, what star would be over that port on the same night. And the difference is just the longitude. It's the star chart.
Yep.
It's so simple that it's hard for us to see it.
Well, and it's fairly similar. It's similar in many aspects to one of the still currently taught methods of navigation, celestial navigation. It wasn't taught for a few years at the Naval Academy because, oh, well, we've got GPS now. Okay, that's great. What if somebody blows all the satellites out of the sky? Oh, well, we'll still need celestial navigation. So they're teaching it again. Bowditch's method used what they called the method of lunar diameters or lunar distances. So you took the apparent diameter of the moon held at arm's length, and which is usually about the same as your thumbnail. And you counted how many of those diameters it was between two fixed stars, or better yet, between two fixed stars and a mobile planetary type body. Then you went to a table, and in less than a minute, you could have your position on the surface of the Earth. But the counting the lunar distances required a tool, and it was probably a chain with lengths about the size of your thumbnail. And just count the number, just hold it up, count the number of lengths between the two stars. You got your distance. So it was rapid. It was within a quarter of a degree of accuracy, even to people who were not very good at it, because all you had to do is look up a table. So those things are lost on anybody who doesn't try to navigate. And that includes most archaeologists and historians. They read what they believe that, oh no, nobody could navigate the Earth before you invented a clock, a maritime chronometer. It's like, you had one, it's up there, it's called the sky. And it's perfect.
Yeah, and our clocks all come from the sky.
It's yes.
The basic stuff. But we're hoodwinked to believe what they teach us. Determining longitude without a clock was something we tested years ago. The same method you're talking about, using Jupiter and the moon. And it's very, very simple. Anybody can understand it if you point it out. I then checked with people who taught geodesy at the university and the naval instructor as well. And they said, well, it's impossible to get longitude unless you got equations of spherical geometry, unless you got a chronometer. End of story. And the same basic stuff that comes from, if you find evidence of contact before Europe, no, that's impossible because there was no contact before Columbus.
Circular logic at its finest.
So then, in this scientific age where we're supposed to use the scientific method, majority of the people now in control of what we think about these things use the old ipsa dicit method, which means he said so as truth, and then throw out the data, not examine it, because it's in contrary to what we believe. Now, I'll just add at this time that the equations of spherical trig, invented by Alberini in 1000 AD, which we say is necessary for all this business, Father Geodesy. He was with the Muslim armies when they were conquering India, 1000 AD, and they've been fighting a long time there. And he found latitude and longitude on old maps for the Silk Road, which were ancient in his time. Well, he knew how to get latitude. That's easy. You get the height of the center of the rotation of the stars. He had no idea how to get longitude. So they wouldn't tell him either how they did it, simply wouldn't tell him. So that gets to the secrecy business that people kept and still do. So he came up with these equations, complex equations. It worked. It worked. Worked fine. But we say we've got to have it. But how did the people before him get longitude on the maps of the, along the Silk Roads for the cities? They didn't use his equations. But we then say you've got to have his equations to do that. You don't. There's a simpler method that the Cheyenne were obviously using in this country and they were using in India before. Alberini got in there and started asking questions.
Agreed.
Jim, what was the, is it Altair? I'm sorry, the one of the constellations that you were, that somebody's working on, is it Altair? That's in the, that's linked with the mounds, or am I mistaken on the name of that star, that's encoded in the mounds that you're working on?
Well, Antares is on one of ours. And that means opposite Aries. Aries means the vernal equinox. So if you can figure out the star that's at your zenith at midnight, that is opposite where the sun is, or the sun's going to be at the vernal equinox, you can figure out where the sun is in invisible stars by looking at the star opposite. So opposite Antares, all you have to do is go to a horoscope and you'll see that's where the vernal equinox was when the whole system started, 4000 BC or something like that.
All right, well.
All this stuff is tied together and they knew it. And because they didn't have the Library of Alexandria, they got burned. They had to wait until the Spanish came and then they burned the temples.
And this stuff can all be learned so quickly if it's just taught to you and it's kept from us. You know, it's simple stuff. That's what's upsetting.
Well, yeah, we are taught what is possible. We say that the monks in the Dark Ages told us what's possible. Well, we've got equivalent of monks today, not wearing black robe, but white robes in the labs, telling us what's possible. When our students found out how to trisect angles and square circles with geometry, the same riddles that priests in Egyptian temples chided Euclid to figure out by his superior Greek knowledge. He spent his life trying to figure out and couldn't. So we teach it's impossible. It's not impossible at all. So we were trying to show a professor who taught engineering students, beginning engineering students, how we found out how to trisect angles and square circles. He wouldn't listen. He said, stop right now. That's impossible to do. I don't have time for listening to that baloney. So that's a perfect example. And then you're still teaching it's impossible. My students who have passed the intro on to say, well, why do they teach that? Why indeed? Because we've got our belief systems that are stronger than the scientific knowledge that we profess is what we're going to use today. And that's in mathematics. And if you take it to archaeology, it is even
right. More
problem because they aren't taught at all. You could get a PhD in archaeology when I was teaching without any assured exposure to the scientific method at all. So don't expect archaeologists to behave like an engineer. Can't.
Well, the other thing about archaeology in the terms of science, so to speak, it's not a science. It's a behavioral study. Because if you try to perform science on any material culture, you've ruined your experiment. There is no way to duplicate it. It is on that particular object. You can only get to do it once. So nobody can duplicate your methods and duplicate your scientific study because you destroyed your object. You took it out of situ in order to do the test. And you must take it out of situ to do the test. So you can't duplicate that test on that object ever again. That's not really the problem I see in archaeology or anthropology. It is the dogma part of it. These people couldn't possibly have been smarter than I am today. Therefore, none of this that we're discussing matters. That's the dogma that you have in archaeology.
Well, it's nice that we don't have dogmas today in our society. We did in the 1800s. When we're trying to get missionaries to save the souls of the people in China and places like that, India, there was a returning missionary who came back and said, "This is a book I found in India, and it shows ancient India astronomy, and see how they knew the size of the moon relative to the earth, and how big the earth was relative to what they could measure, the distance between the two." So he worked up this to publish, and a professor at Harvard, I think his name was, Whitney or something like that, can be found. He says, "This is baloney." He says, "There's no way these little dark people in India would have known such high knowledge. They must have got them from the Greeks." Uh-huh. He published. And of course, there was a response from the universities in India, and some of the Frenchmen got involved, and they proved that indeed it didn't come from the Greeks. As a matter of fact, the Greeks probably got it from India, and that the people from India had calendars at least 12,000 years ago. And China, probably 14,000 years ago. And our Greeks come along at 1,000 BC.
Yeah.
So, although in the world arena, he got shot down, nevertheless, we honor him because he's our hero and not those people from India. So to me, it's really clear that high knowledge came from India, not 1,000 BC, but thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what the people from India say.
Knowing what you do for a living, I have to ask this question. Are you aware of a landform they call Adam's Bridge that stretches from the southern tip of India out to Ceylon?
Well, not by name, but yeah, there's stories that.
Yeah, there's an isthmus. It's submerged now,
Monkey Bridge or something like that.
Yes, that's another name for it. Yeah, it before the ice melt, 8,000-12,000 years ago, depending on which version is true for that part of the Indian Ocean, you could walk from India to Ceylon. What is it, 100 miles or so now?
Yeah.
Not now.
I know. Yeah, there's no mystery there. A lot of places like that. Doggerland between France.
Yes. And yeah, the thing about the Monkey Bridge or Adam's Bridge, it looks to be artificial. It's man-made. Well, okay, it's artificial, whether it was man or not.
Well, if you can build a causeway before the water gets too high, you're going to use it.
Yes, I think that's exactly what happened. But there had to have been enough traffic to warrant it. Yeah. And that traffic was, 8, 10, 12,000 years ago.
Yeah, and then there's no reason that didn't know about boats either in those days.
I'm sure they did.
what's coming out of Mohenjo-Daro now is that they had big forests there like Cedars of Lebanon, where they split logs into planks and sewed the planks together, and they were building boats that were 200 and 300 feet long.
Yeah, and using
back in the days before Noah, you know.
And for some reason, India, which was part of China, you know, this whole big area, and you had light-skinned, medium-skinned, dark-skinned. For some reason, the Indians are just not taught in American schools how smart they were and how sophisticated. It's like, I never learned anything about India growing up. How outrageous.
Well, I guess it's Raman Lal then, and a few people like that, who have been saying that their people did come to this country long before Columbus.
Oh yeah, and there are artifacts that support that. Not just my opinion, but I've seen enough of them to believe, be convinced would be a better term, that Indians visited Central America and maybe even North America. We have effigy mounds that you're aware of, I'm sure, in Iowa and Wisconsin that certainly appear to show elephants. We have elephants depicted in Mayan art from 800 AD. And they are definitely Asian elephants. So why is that being ignored?
Well, I can relate to what I was taught in the grade school, a one-room country school about history. America was separate from Europe after the land bridge, 13,000 BC, where some people, all the Indian ancestors walked across. And then it was cut off and there was no contact at all until Columbus came. And mm-hmm. he saved the souls of the natives
mm-hmm.
and brought them to a higher education and understanding. And therefore, when it came time to take their land, the myth of manifest destiny was preached from the church pulpits and university lecterns that we had the God-given right to take the land. And to that, Pamita responded, that was just an invention to steal our land so that your ancestors did not have a guilty conscience. That's with us still. So if we allow, as Shaman Lal says, the wall around America that we have built to be breached, then what? Then our myth of manifest destiny taking the Indian land is hollow. And so it's a political duty to a lot of people to maintain that myth.
Yeah.
And it's our Native Americans who say, let's expose it. And the rest of us saying, cover it up.
Well, except for us three right now.
Well, we're kind of heretics, you know.
We are, definitely. They don't like us hanging around the archaeological museums much.
I'll see you in hell.
Yep. We'll have our own little corner. At any rate, we have consumed an entire hour in this discussion.
We did not. It has not been an hour.
It has.
All right.
Well, Jim, it's always amazing.
Yeah. Rick has a bar to run. And what do I have? I got something today. Jim, what do you have today?
I don't know. There's something coming up. Oh, I've got to go up to visit the guy at a site. Oh, this is interesting. The ASCII site up by Baraboo, which is made out of rocks before the effigy mounds. It's including latitude and I think trade route and possibly a bison kill area in the days when there were still bison in this area. So I've got to go up there and talk to a guy about it.
What fun days you have, Jim. What very fun days you have. And I'm sure if we found out the next few weeks, you have a bunch of different sites and we'll have a bunch of different stories for us. You are going to be part 2, 3, 4, 5. Let's just wrap up today for right now. And that was a heck of a lot of fun. So thank you, Jim.
Okay.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
All right. We'll
look forward to seeing you in October, Jim.
Oh, I don't think I'm going to get up there, Rick.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to, and I have a conflict. The same date for my conference presentation is the 50-year class reunion for my high school graduation. So, yeah. Oh well.
And I might rent a car and come see you, Jim, if the virus isn't too bad. So I hope to see you if it works out. Okay.
Well, let's keep it up. This Zoom business saves a lot of driving, and it's really neat. I've got to start writing, putting some of this stuff pulled together for 40 years on paper. And I need some place where I can deposit it and also have somebody proof it. Try to see if we can find holes. Are you guys up for that? By sending papers?
Yeah, of course, Jim. And our website, which us three created, which Jim, you paid for, ancientamerica.com. You can buy or download for free, actually. Dozens of your writings, Jim, that you have written over the years, probably 30. Your books, your papers are, you still have a lot to write, but we have a lot available for free. And your surveying work, as I've been told, Jim, is there's nobody like you on planet Earth, and there never will be somebody like you again. So your contribution to this world on surveying is a thousand mounds type thing, and effigies is will not be forgotten. So you got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me.
Get to work. Get to work. Okay. All right. Thank you, you guys. We'll talk really soon.
Very good. Well, thanks for setting all this up, you guys.
Good job. We'll share this with the world, Jim. Good job, Rick. Good. Thank you.
I look forward to the next time, both of you.
Okay.
Bye.
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 Bye.